It is truly an honor for me to be here at Parkdale United for your 10th celebration of MLK Day. Whenever I am invited to pulpit, notice I'm touching it. So very often people say to me, oh, you know, the pulpit, you grew up as a minister's child, so, you know, the pulpit must be like family, part of the furniture, part of the family. And I say, well, if you had grown up as a minister's child, you'd know that that's not true. That, in fact, the pulpit is an instrument of torture for those of us whose parents are in the ministry. Because every Sunday you go into church, and it doesn't matter even if you sit at the back of the church. Everybody knows that you're related to that person standing up there. And so you sit there with your fingers crossed, hoping that you didn't do anything over the past week that they can use in their sermon. And even if there isn't anything that they can use, that they just won't embarrass you in and of themselves. But since I have started speaking, I've found that, you know, it goes around. What comes around goes around. And I have so much fun in telling stories about my children. And each time I go somewhere, they're like, Mom, please don't talk about us. I can't help it. You just give me such good material. But I was struck by our readings this morning. In particular, at the very beginning of the Old Testament lesson, the words, the voice of the Lord was not known much in those days. And I was struck by that because I remember growing up and reading the Bible and thinking, wouldn't it have been so much easier to be born in those days when there were prophets or when Jesus was walking around? Because then, you know, everything was set out for you. There were these prophets who God talked to, and then they would come and say, the Lord says. And, you know, and you knew that they were, you know, they were having that conversation. So it just set everything out. It's just so unfair that then I got born in 19-something and missed out on those, yeah, well, close to 20-something, actually. No, I'm joking. But that I missed out then on those wonderful days when the voice of God was clear, that the messages from God, that when somebody said, the Lord says I should tell you, you knew they had been in conversation with God. And I thought, man, that's what I want. I want to live in the time of prophets. And I want to live in the time when the voice of God is common. And then, when I was about 19, somebody published a book of my dad's sermons, and they titled the book, A Voice Crying in the Wilderness. And I was like, huh? This man? Isn't that what they said about prophets? And so I then started looking around our world, listening to stories of people who showed that they cared, who showed that they loved the world, who showed that they loved God, who showed that they loved us. And as I listened to the stories of the Gandhi, the stories of Martin Luther King Jr., and even some of the stories of Desmond Tutu, I realized that there were still people listening and hearing the voice of God. And as I was thinking about what it is that I want to do with my life, I once said to my spiritual director, you know, I am holding out for a Damascus experience. I want God to stop me somewhere and say, this is what I want you to do. And I don't mind if I have to go blind for a few months for that to happen. And she said, I don't don't think you really mean that. But I can tell you that God is talking to you each and every day if you will be quiet and listen. And so I started trying to be quiet and listen. And like Samuel, so often when God spoke, it sounded like somebody else's voice. It sounded like the voice of my grandmother, who was a domestic worker in South Africa. And one day when we went to get her from her job, I heard the children in the house where she worked calling her by her first name. And I was so angry at them. And I was so angry at her. Because in our culture, age in and of itself bestows respect. So I don't even call my older sister by her first name. I have an honorific that I put in front of her name that says Big Sister. And I keep fighting with my children to try and make sure that they do the same. And that to hear somebody my age calling my grandmother by her first name just made me so angry. And when we got home, I yelled at her. And I said, how can you let them treat you like that? How can you let them disrespect you like that? I respect you. You're somebody I look up to. I expect you to make sure that others respect you too. And she said to me, you know, the value of your worth is not how others treat you, but how you treat others. And I heard the voice of God. Sometimes the voice of God would come from people thousands of miles away from South Africa, from apartheid, that seemed to sap even our souls sometimes. Like when my father won the Nobel Peace Prize and we went to Norway for the celebration. And at that point, I'm sure they've probably changed the policy by now, but at that point, the Nobel Committee said, you can invite as many people as you like to the ceremony. You don't say that to an African, you know? That's dangerous, you know? Because we got there, and I swear there were about 100 of us, people who my father said had a part in his prize. People from South Africa, from the South African Council of Churches, people from England, from when he had been a student there and who had supported us in that time, people from the United States who had been part of the movement of the churches and students in opposition to apartheid. But there were a lot of us. But one of the people who was there from South Africa was somebody who had only just recently been released from detention. And when we got to Norway, he said, there's this family that I have to find. And 2 days later, he came to us and said, this is my family. Now, he's South African, and he looks like me, and these people are blonde. I'm like, this is your family? He said, yes. These people adopted my family when I was in detention. They wrote to my wife and children. They let them know that they were holding them in their prayers. They sent them money. They sent them love. This is my family. And I saw in those Norwegians and heard in their letters and love the voice of God telling me that there are people who love you. There are people who understand your struggle. There are people who see your struggle as theirs. Sometimes I would see and hear the voice of God in myself, in those times when I was just quiet. And it was so often in those times when I was just so mad at somebody or something. And, you know, as I said to the children, that I'm the middle child. And let me tell you, there are many times to be extremely furious at somebody. There's always somebody in your way. You know, I was always telling my parents, you know, I can understand the two who came before me. You were trying for me, perfection. But why continue? You know? But even beyond my siblings, I remember when I had been working in Connecticut for a while after I finished graduate school. I worked in Connecticut and went home on vacation. And I had, for the first time, a driver's license and a credit card. And so I got home and I rented a car and I was off to show off to my cousins that here am I, an employed woman driving a car, got my credit card. Okay. And this was in the 80s, at the time of the state of emergency in South Africa. So around the black townships, there were always military roadblocks. So as I drove up to a roadblock and my car was stopped and the young man told me to get out of my car. And, you know, part of our resistance, if you like, to apartheid was to show how nonchalant and uncaring we were about things like roadblocks and searches. And so when he stopped me and asked me to get out of the car, I walked out with an attitude, you know. Standing by the side of my car, giving him not many looks at all. But then I happened to really look into his face. And he looked about 18 or 19, and he looked terrified. And my first thought is, what have you got to be scared of? You're the one with a gun, you know? But then I heard a voice saying, what must he have been told about you to be doing what he does? And so I turned to him and I said, man, you must have a boring life that this is what you're doing on a Friday night, searching people's cars. And he laughed. And we talked for a couple of minutes. Now, you know, a really nice story would be for me to say, and now I'm the godparent of his firstborn, and we see each other whenever I'm in South Africa. The truth is, I drove away. I've never seen him again. But for a moment, I heard the voice of God saying, this is my child. And I believe that he saw in me not simply a potential terrorist, but another human being. And what Dr. King has shown us in his life is that we each can hear the voice of God and live out the calling and challenge of that voice in our lives. Now, we're not all going to be leading boycotts or marches or speaking from the Lincoln Memorial or leading a mass movement of people to change a whole society. But for
each of us, there is that voice that tells us what we are called to be and to do in our world. It might be just at that time that you decide to walk past that homeless person on the street, that you hear the voice of God saying, if that were you, what would you want someone seeing you to do? It might be at that moment that that colleague, that client, that family member has pushed you right to the brink of your last nerve. That voice says, what must be going on in him, in her, for her to be doing or saying this to you? I remember when I worked at the Race Relations Institute at Fisk, we had a conference on campus around opposition to the death penalty that we had put together with the Tennessee Coalition to Abolish State Killing. And it was a regional conference, and we had asked the campus to open facilities to us and to make available classrooms, the library, the cafeteria, different things for this conference. And one of the places was the library. And we had in the library this woman who just was being mean to every single person who was involved with the conference. And each time I would say to somebody, can you go to the library, they would turn around and say, why don't you send her? You know, I'm really busy right now. Or why don't you go yourself? Because I've had to deal with her 3 or 4 times already today. And by the end of the weekend, our co-sponsors were saying to us, you know, everybody on this campus was so welcoming, was so wonderful to us, except for this one person in the library. What was going on with her? And so when we had our staff meeting to talk about it, I said to people, does anybody know what was going on with the person in the library? And nobody did. And I said, well, you know, we've missed the chance to ask her what was going on. But how about we send her a basket of flowers? And just say, thank you so much for all your hard work. And so we sent a basket of flowers from the staff of the Race Relations Institute and to thank her for all the work she had done in putting together our conference. A week later, she came to our offices and said, you know, I wasn't on my best that weekend. There was some stuff going on at home, and I'm really glad that I didn't show that to you so that I, you know, since you sent me the flowers. And it's like, thank you, thank you. But it was that little voice that said, what could possibly be going on in her that she would be doing this to you? And it is that voice, I believe, that sustained and encouraged Dr. King in those times when he was enemy number one to the U.S. government and to many of the people of the United States. The knowledge that what I do out of love. That what I do to reach out to you. That I have no interest in pushing you away. I have no interest in repaying slight for slight, evil for evil. That I see in you a brother and a sister And I see in us the opportunity to build a beloved community. And you know, that opportunity continues for each of us, wherever we may be, whoever we may be. That so, so very often, it is easy to write off those who don't agree with us. To see them as uneducated, stupid, immoral, whatever word we want to come up with, depending on what the circumstance is of their disagreement with us. But the real challenge for us is to go beneath all of that and hear the voice of God telling us, you are mine, and so is he, and so is she. And what you are called to be and do in this world is to reach out. To be not those who close yourselves off or close others out, but to be those who open your hearts, your community, your struggle to all. And I know that I have been truly fortunate in my life to grow up in South Africa during apartheid and to have prophets so obvious amongst us. The Beyers Nodiers, who was prepared for a role of leadership in the Afrikaner community upholding apartheid and became one of the strongest voices challenging that system. Though he was denied by his family, by his church, by his whole community, to have heard the voices of people like Stephen Bantu Biko, who was detained and banned and tortured and finally killed, but who always said that South Africa will be free. And when black South Africa is free, white South Africa will also be free. To be surrounded by prophets like Helen Suzman, who just recently died, who was the only woman in Parliament and the only opposition member in Parliament, who spoke up over and over against apartheid. So I feel fortunate to have lived a life surrounded by prophets. And I know that the truth is we all live a life surrounded by prophets. And that we all have the opportunity to be prophets ourselves. I so like Jesus' words that just because I told you
that I could see you under the fig tree. That's what amazed you and made you know that I am God. Well, you are going to see many, many more wondrous things. And I believe that we are going to be those who see and make many, many more wondrous things happen. That we are going to be those who pass on to our children a world without hunger. A world in which our children can grow in peace and safety. That we will be those who see wondrous things, because we've already seen wondrous things. The end of apartheid, the falling of the Berlin Wall. That we have seen those wondrous things, and we have an opportunity to be a part of even more wonderful things. When I was growing up and we were living in Lesotho while my father was teaching at the university, one of the things that he did to augment the salary was to grade exams. You know, in Southern Africa, people write external exams at the end of high school, and those exams are sent out to be graded by different people. And so my father graded religious knowledge, religious education exam papers. And every once in a while, he would share with us some of the doozies that people would write in responding to these exams. And, you know, one of the instructions I think that teachers must have given students was, don't leave an answer blank. Put in something, because you never know. You know, you might just get it right. And so one of the exam questions was, what did the voice from heaven say as Jesus stepped out from being baptized? And one of the students had written, the voice said, remember you're the Son of God and act like it. And I believe we are called to remember that we are children of God. Each of us. All of us. And to act as though we know that. Amen.